What causes ghostly experiences? Are ghosts real? Why do some people report numerous ghostly encounters and some others say they have never seen anything? In a moment, Brandon Masullo joins us. We're going to be talking about his latest work, The Ghost Studies, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you and our guest Brandon Masullo with us. Brandon is a clinical therapist, author, parapsychologist residing in the northeastern section of Ohio. He has a graduate degree in clinical counseling from the University of Toledo, psychological research methods from the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. His research at the University of Edinburgh centered on EMFs, environmental sensitivity, and ghostly encounters. Brandon has been fascinated by the paranormal for years, and here he is with his work called The Ghost Studies. Brandon, I'm looking forward to this. Welcome to the show.
It's great to be here, George. I'm excited, too.
My gosh, how did a clinical therapist get involved in ghost studies?
Well, actually, I was interested in ghosts and parapsychology before I was actually a clinical therapist.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so I actually got a day job, and then I studied the parapsychology and ghost part of things.
Well, that's something. And you went to the University of Toledo, which is not too far from my hometown of Detroit.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, I spent a lot of time at the casino in Detroit, but we won't get into that.
How'd you do, by the way?
Not very well.
That's good. Well, let's see. They didn't have casinos there when I left. I left in 78. Went to Minneapolis for a year, and at that time it was just a booming city. But what we do have is the Detroit Lions, and that's the great thing there.
Yeah, yeah. Good teams up there sports-wise.
So tell us a little bit about your work, and then we're going to digest ourselves into the Ghost Studies book. But give us an overview of what you've been doing, Brandon.
Well, I have a degree in parapsychology. When I was at the University of Edinburgh, I studied basically the environmental sensitivity and ghostly encounters. And then when I got back here to the States, I got back into the clinical part of things. And then that's what kind of got me going and interested in writing a book. And that's when I came out with The Ghost Studies. And, you know, I'm sure the listeners to your show know it's no mystery that science has sort of dropped the ball when it comes to explaining ghostly encounters. Oftentimes, mainstream academia will explain these things away as hallucinations,
yep,
interpretations, or overactive imaginations, which, you know, is not really true in my eyes. So individuals who have these terrifying encounters kind of struggle to find answers, and they're kind of left with reality television shows to provide insight into these life-altering experiences. So, you know, there's millions of people out there, including myself, who were looking for things or books with more than just ghost stories, tales of locations, or outdated views. And that's when I wrote the book, and I just felt, you know, I combined real-life ghostly encounters with the satisfaction of some new perspectives and insights and the cause of these thrilling encounters. The book comes up with concise, encompassing theories. And what's great about it is it's based on data rather than faith or belief or even experience. And, you know, these ghosts have been piquing our interest for millions of years. And I think we're at the point where there's becoming new perspectives on these things, and that's what the book really goes over. You know, there's several firsthand accounts of ghostly encounters. You know, I spent years just getting firsthand accounts, going to anyone who would talk to me about ghosts,
yeah,
paranormal conventions, everywhere. And then I started noticing similarities, and that's when I came up with some of these new theories. And that's when I came out with the book. So, you know, I really combined a little bit of I took elements from psychological research, clinical interviews, eyewitness accounts, and I sort of pieced them together and come up with these new theories and thoughts. And I also reviewed the latest research in ghostly encounters in the book.
Well, then you bring a dose of real science to the picture here, Brandon, and I think that's important.
Yeah, and I think so too. I mean, the great thing is it's out there. You just got to look a little bit harder. The journal articles, parapsychological journal articles, and even to some degree, you know, neuropsychology, physics, they're starting to kind of go into that realm of consciousness and entanglement and non-locality and how electricity affects us and what it does outside the body. So there's a lot of that research out there. It's just, you know, I think a lot of people maybe don't know how to find it, or when they do find it and read a research article, it comes like, oh, this is boring and I don't know what's going on. But a lot of great research is out there. It's just a matter of finding it.
What have you concluded to date, Brandon, about what this ghostly experience might be for someone? Real? Figment of their imagination? What do you think's happening?
I actually think majority of the ghostly encounters that are out there, I believe there's some paranormal phenomenon happening. You know, I think that when it comes to ghostly encounters, it's such a complex process, and there's so many variables going on. You know, there's environmental stuff, there's internal bioelectrical stuff going on. But, you know, for the most part, these experiences are genuine. And, you know, obviously there's some fraud and there's some misinterpreting and stimuli or whatever. But I think a majority of these experiences are actually, like I said, genuine experiences.
And what do you think causes them, Brandon? Why do they happen?
Well, I think there's, in my view, I take the more psi-based view on ghosts. So that's, and psi is basically telepathy, extrasensory perception, those types of things. I really think that a lot of ghostly encounters that happen out there, the base of it has to do with telepathy or coming in, being real sensitive to the environment and picking up something that's in the environment that other people aren't. My main theories in the book go over what I call telepathic distress signals and sort of how they play a role in ghostly encounters. So I really think that people's telepathy is a real important part of a ghostly encounter.
How important then is the person as opposed to the event for something like this?
I think that it's kind of a 50-50 thing, and I know that's kind of a weird answer to say there, but I think there's so many people out there. I think there's a lot of people out there that are more prone to ghostly encounters, but I also think that the event is sort of the catalyst to everything that's happening. So when I say that, you know, I think if we look at a lot of the ghostly encounters that are out there, the catalyst is usually a crisis of some kind, right? A death, a life-threatening event, some sort of trauma, something like that is the catalyst to these ghostly encounters. So the event is an important part of it. It's what happens after that event. And I think when you have the events, when you have this trauma, I think it sort of, there's a lot of things that happen after that. And one of those things is, you know, emotional distress. So you have an event, you have an emotional distress, trauma, life-threatening. You're going to have all these emotions that are associated with it. And then that leads to sort of these bioenergetic shifts that happen inside us. I mean, we're all electricity. And when that happens, I think that it actually triggers sort of our innate ability to send a distress signal to somebody else. And a great classic example of this is the crisis apparition, all right? So we've probably heard of these. This is when I'm sitting in my room on a random Tuesday night, and I look to the left, and there's an apparition of my aunt, and she says, you know, I love you, goodbye. And then I get a call the next day saying, you know, my aunt passed away right at the time that I had that.
Right.
And I think that you can sort of see there was a trauma, life-threatening event with my aunt. She was dying. And somehow she sent a telepathic distress signal saying to me, and I picked up on it, and it showed up as an apparition of some kind.
Yet, as you say, some people don't get these experiences. Why not?
Well, I think it actually comes down to something pretty mundane. There's a lot of research out there in something called environmental sensitivity. All right? And what environmental sensitivity is, it's not like psychic sensitivity. It's not like Chip Coffey and Sylvia Brown and those types of psychic sensitivity where you're mediums and you have psychic abilities. But something as simple and concrete as sort of our ability to taste, touch, and smell. And that's what environmental sensitivity is. So those who are environmentally sensitive are simply picking up on the environment to a higher degree than the normal population. So if you think about this, as humans, me and you, we both experience the world differently. We're both affected by and react to the environment in different ways. But the physical environment affects certain people more than others. And this leads to all kinds of conditions and dysfunctions. There's a researcher out there, Michael Jauer, who categorized these environmentally sensitive people. And what he found was people who are environmentally sensitive have, you know, long-standing allergies, chronic pain, fatigue, migraines, fibromyalgia, and just an overt sensitivity to light, sound, electricity, and smells, more than maybe me and you do. So I could walk into a room and be fine. Other people could walk into the same room and they smell cologne from all over the place. They start getting rashes. So these environmentally sensitive people actually have way, way, way more paranormal experiences than the general population. It's a really high number. And what the thought is these environmentally sensitive people are picking up on whether it's external magnetic fields more than the general population. In other words, they have a better antenna or biological radio in the electromagnetic spectrum than other people. So we all have radios with basic equipment to tune into things. But some people have really, really, really redefined or sensitive radios, and they're picking up on things and detecting things in the environment that normal people don't pick up or the general population doesn't. So this ability to truly experience paranormal phenomenon, it's more likely to be detected or registered among this group. And I think that's a fascinating thing. So we have environmental sensitivity, which there's a lot of research suggesting obviously it's viable and it's real. I think in Canada you can be on disability for certain types of environmental sensitivity. So there's science behind it, and then there's also science saying these people are having way more ghostly encounters. Why is that? Mm-hmm. And then that's kind of where we go a little further into that.
Do some of these people, Brandon, realize how sensitive they are to picking up these things? I mean, do they know they get it?
I think they do. And when I went out there and my research was done, I talked to a lot of people who are environmentally sensitive. And what you find is, you know, not only do they pick up on things or have way more paranormal experiences, but it's genetic. So their mom did too, or their dad, and then their grandma, and so forth and so on. So this is something kind of like most, you know, genetic diseases or whatnot that's kind of passed down from generation. And listen, they know they're sensitive to the environment just by walking into places. Some people, you know, like I said, get rashes. They can't be under neon lights. Some people are almost allergic to electricity. So these types of people just experience a different world. And believe me, they know it affects them probably more negatively than it does positively.
You know, you talked about some of the reality television shows, Brandon, and my criticism of them, because they always seem that they have to have some kind of ghostly encounter because it's television. And, you know, they don't want to do their 30-minute or one-hour program and not have anything happen. So it looks like they create these things. And I think that kind of hurts the credibility of some of these episodes, don't you?
Yeah, I think it really does, too. Because it implies that either people are misinterpreting normal things or there's overt fraud. And, you know, those people who do this on a regular basis and are genuine know, you know, out of 10 locations that you go to, you might have one experience. It's really impossible to have, you know, 30 or 40 experiences every time you go to a location. Because then you're muddying the waters and then you kind of lean towards that fraud type of thing.
Well, so we've talked about the individual who might have the ability to spot ghosts or feel ghosts more than others. But what about the ghost itself? Are there some ghosts that come back more often than others because they have an ability to do that?
I think it's really, I guess, which one is stronger when you think about it? Is the person's ability to sense a ghost? If I'm really sensitive to it, I'm going to pick up ghostly encounters a lot more than everyone else. So I might pick up on a ghostly encounter of a Civil War soldier very often if I'm really sensitive.
I mean, a good radio, a real good radio, probably from C. Crane, has the ability to pick up a weak signal from a radio station. Isn't it much that way with a person, that if that person is a good receiver, he or she may be more apt to pick up these ghostly things.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, that's kind of what boils down to the environmental sensitive person. They're going to have way, way, way more ghostly encounters. And so I think it has to do, to your prior question, I think it has to do mainly with the person, not so much the ghostly encounter or the environment. But you have to ask, you know, hey, I'm an environmentally sensitive person. I pick up on all this stuff. You know, I go from place to place to place throughout my day. However, one location I'm picking up a lot of, I'm having a lot of ghostly phenomenon happen to me. The place is pretty active, whereas another place isn't. So then you start asking yourself, well, why that place and why not the other places? So then you have to go into why does a location have more paranormal phenomena encounters than other locations? You know, it's like those antennas we had, the rabbit ear ones. You know, why is this configuration picking up channel 33 and this configuration isn't? You know what I'm saying? You have to figure out the right combination of things that happen for the TV to show up in a clear picture. And the same with ghostly encounters. You have to figure out the right sort of ingredients or variables that line up to have a ghostly encounter. Location is one, person is two, and then there's probably other ones that we haven't really identified at this point. But the person, not only is their sensitivity, but their internal bioelectrics, consciousness, all this stuff really plays into it. And it's really fascinating, to me at least.
Yeah, it really is. I remember when my dad brought home a better TV antenna, and it was the kind that didn't just move with the rabbit ears, but it had like a little knob on it that you clicked, and it brought in the signals better that way, too. And I thought, boy, is this technology amazing. How times have changed, Brandon.
I remember those, too. So.
Do you or have you come across demonic spirits in your work?
No, I haven't. And I get that question a lot, though. The demon question seems to be getting more and more prevalent in the last 5 years or so. I think, you know, when you have a ghostly encounter or you have some sort of phenomenon happen to you, it's amazing, it's great, and then you want to start maybe putting labels on it. You know, this experience, was it good? Was it bad? Was it positive? Was it this? Was it that? And I think when you start putting negative to it, then you start feeling like it's demonic.
Mm-hmm,
but really,
right.
Demonic and demon is more of a religious perspective than it is sort of, a scientific perspective. So usually whoever classifies this as a demon or, a regular ghost, I think there's more of a religious tilt to it. That's why usually when I meet demonologists, they're very religious as well. So I think there's a little of that labeling going on. To me, it's an experience, and some people perceive it as good or bad. I might perceive one experience being really positive. You might have the same experience and be terrified and believe it's negative. And then kind of you go towards the more demonic part of things. So I really just I have the experience, I research the experience, and I don't try to put the demon label on anything.
Well, with Brandon Masullo, his book is called The Ghost Studies. His website, hauntedtheories.com. Of course, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. He's also on Facebook and Twitter as well. We've got those links for you, too, at coasttocoastam.com. We're going to come back in a moment, continue chatting with him about his book, of course, The Ghost Studies. Then in our final hour of the night, we'll take your phone calls with him right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We're back with Brandon Masullo, author of The Ghost Studies. Brandon, can you've interviewed a number of people with some case studies. Let's talk a couple of them, some of your favorites. What do you have?
Sure. So I have several real-life accounts that I go over. The first one is actually, because Halloween's approaching, I'll go with this one.
Perfect. Trick or treat.
My wife had passed away unexpectedly over the summer. While it's been difficult, I've managed to care for the house myself. As Halloween approached, I was putting up decorations, as the kids in the neighborhood usually love trick-or-treating. My wife and I had bought a plastic pumpkin together when we first got married 20 years ago. We had placed this plastic pumpkin in our window every Halloween. I searched the house for days looking for that pumpkin until I finally gave up. A few days after giving up, I was walking down the staircase, and I was shocked to see my wife standing at the bottom. She smiled and whispered, "Check behind the workbench," and then vanished. I began to weep uncontrollably and rushed out to the garage. A huge smile came across my face as the plastic pumpkin was laying behind the workbench. It must have fallen off the top shelf. So this is a great example of, you mentioned it before, an intelligent haunting or ghost interacting with us. So in this case, you know, the ghost, during this ghostly encounter, the ghost had a conscience, and she was actually giving information that the husband wanted. So they're aware of their surroundings. They're giving information. They're not sort of confined to an area. They're interacting with the witness. They're not like routine specific, like they don't just show up every day on the 25th of May or on Christmas Eve or anything like that. So this direct interaction is sort of the cream of the crop when it comes to ghostly encounters. And these are the most rare ones that I've, in talking with people, these are the most rare when you have like intelligence, the interaction, the giving information, which is verified. This is sort of what we all seek, in a way, those who investigate the paranormal.
Is there a pecking order on the other side, Brandon, in your opinion, of authority? I mean, who sends the ghost back to do what it does? Does it do it on its own, or is there some organization that's involved in doing that on the other side?
I'm a strong believer in consciousness. So, you know, who we are as people, our personality, our memories, our everything that we are, after we die, you know, what happens to that, right? Some people will say that we're just computers, and when we die, everything of who we are, our memories, it just ceases to exist. And that's kind of mainstream science's view. But when you look at things, if consciousness survives death and it goes and it continues to exist, it could maybe be in the environment to some degree. And I think when needed, maybe like an example with a husband, when needed, he can sort of resonate or link up with the consciousness of his past wife. So I don't think it's a pecking order as much as, you know, someone just really needs something, and then they sort of resonate with the consciousness of a past loved one, and then these experiences maybe happen. So, yeah, you know, I really believe that there's obviously things in the environment that we don't know about, and the consciousness, electromagnetic fields, all this stuff that really happens in the environment is really important. Michael Persinger, who recently passed away but was a neuropsychologist, basically said, and he did all the numbers behind this, but that the environment holds enough energy for every person that ever lives, their consciousness to exist in it, which means we have access to memories from Abraham Lincoln to Billy the Kid. It's all out there, and the environment has enough energy to store all that. And then maybe some people can just connect with that or resonate with that, and that's when these great experiences happen.
What do you say to skeptics, Brandon, who say these people who have these encounters are mentally unstable or something even worse?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think, you know, when someone tells you a ghostly encounter, a lot of people will just kind of say, "Well, you're crazy." And they kind of say it jokingly, but it really makes the other person feel like they're, you know, they might be crazy. So, you know, what I usually tell people who skeptics or things like that, I usually just basically kind of go over, listen, you know, in my experience, it's all I do all day is diagnose mental health and you know.
Oh, you see it all.
Yeah, I mean, my job, I worked in the ER for 7 years, so I just did behavioral health assessments on med floors in the ER, and I've done probably 5,000 assessments over the course of 10 years. So I know how to parcel out, you know, significant mental health issues. And all these real-life encounters that I've come across, 99.9% of them are from people who were genuine and had a subjective paranormal experience.
That's huge.
Yeah, you know, and I think that it's easy to say, oh, you're crazy, or you're this, or you're that, or you're unstable, or you're hallucinating, or you're drinking too much, or withdrawing, or whatever the situation is. But listen, in my professional opinion, a lot of these ghostly encounters are the they're genuine in the people's eyes. It's not the result of mental illness.
Well, I've always found that skepticism is healthy as long as a true skeptic has an open mind.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, exactly. You know, it's really easy to be, you know, a steadfast believer or a steadfast skeptic.
Right.
Because you can just engulf yourself in whatever you're reading, journals, magazines, books, and it's really easy to sort of say, everything is not a ghost or everything is a ghost. It's being in between and open-minded that's the most rewarding and challenging, because you have to take both sides. You have to read the skeptical stuff, and you also have to read the believer stuff. And you have to have common sense in a way and sort of parcel out what's fraud or fake or just people being overzealous, and then come up with your own conclusions. And that's where you're right. The open-mindedness part is essential when it comes to being involved in the paranormal.
Yeah, it really is.
I was a skeptic for pretty much a majority of my life.
What changed you?
You know, when people would tell me, and I was really interested in parapsychology, like I said before, but I never had an experience. So I always kind of thought, well, these people who are having experiences, maybe they're just misinterpreting things and just getting it wrong. So when people would tell me experiences, I would kind of sit there, and as they're talking, I wouldn't even listen to them. I would just sort of go over how to debunk it or what could be happening. And then I just stood back and, I'm going to start listening. And I started listening. And I'm like, oh, okay. And then I started picking up books like Carl Jung's Collective Unconscious,
right,
Sheldrake stuff, Harold Saxenberg's Life Field.
Did you ever read Raymond Moody's work?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Near-death experiences, all this stuff. And you start reading it and you go, wait a minute, there's actually, this might be happening. And then you go deeper down that rabbit hole and you're reading research articles about entanglement. And then you kind of go, wait a minute, this is actually somewhat possible. And then, you know, as far as telepathy and things like that, I mean, the research on that is growing every year. I know every year I'm reading more and more journal articles, which statistically give credence to the idea that telepathy and ESP and the psi phenomenon is legit. And then you're like, well, wait a minute, if all this is saying this, then these ghostly encounters could be possible as well. And that's kind of what led me into it from a skeptical to more of a believer part of things.
Give us another one of your favorite stories.
All right. I got a lot of them. So we'll go with one that's been pretty popular here recently. It has to do with dimensions. Anne just finished eating dinner and was in the kitchen cleaning things up. As I was placing items in the dishwasher, I happened to look in the dining room. I was shocked to see a huge black void about 4 feet high and 4 feet wide hovering above the ground. I immediately thought something was terribly wrong with my eyes. I looked away, rubbed my eyes, and then looked back, and the void was still there. As I walked closer, I could see a mother and her child inside the void. The mother and child were sitting in the grass, talking and smiling while enjoying the bright sunny day. They were dressed in what I would describe as 1800 clothing that I've seen in Western movies. It was as if I was watching a floating TV. The mother then made eye contact with me and appeared confused and scared. Terrified, she grabbed her child and ran away. I don't know if they were ghosts. I got a sense that they were alive as me, however, from a different time. It felt as if I peeked into the past. And this is a common one that I'm hearing more and more about, and it's this idea of wormholes, portals, dimensions, and that sort of under special conditions, I'll call them ghosts, enter into our universe. So in this example, the witness, in a sense, was able to access a previous time or dimension in the universe, and she was able to look back and see what's happening in that location. And maybe the child and the mom saw this woman dressed in futuristic clothing and got terrified and ran away. So it's almost like a glimpse into something else. And a lot of times these are perceived as ghostly encounters.
Do you ever, when you're doing these studies, have you ever encountered something where it even scared you to death?
Personally, no. I haven't been scared that legit. I had an experience. I live in sort of the country, a rural area of Ohio. And one morning, my wife was out of town, and one morning I kept getting these overwhelming feelings, like something's wrong, like fear, like adrenaline, and I was sort of drawn to the outside. We have a 4 acres in a pond. And I said, why do I feel this way? And my dog was feeling the same way, too. Normally, she's pretty calm in the morning, but she was, like, scratching to get outside. So I'm like, you know, my scientific brain's going, just take your shower and go to work and don't worry about it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know what, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to follow through with this. So I opened the door, the dog and me went outside in the backyard, and she's sniffing around, and I'm like, I still got this feeling. And then I looked over at the pond, and I saw something, like, in the pond floating. And I started walking, and then I started running, and it was a neighborhood cat had gotten into the pond and somehow, you know, drowned in there.
Oh, geez.
But, you know, I dove into the pond, you know, all that stuff. But I thought to myself, it's not so much scary. Looking back on it, it's a little scary, but something drew me out there. You know, I go to work every day, you know, it's the same thing, and I never got that feeling or that desire to go outside. But something happened, and I kept asking myself, what happened? What made that day different? And was there some sort of, like, distress signal sent to me? Was the cat in distress, and it kind of linked with me and the dog? And then I, you know, so that's, it's not scary in a sense, but looking back on it, it's kind of like, there's so many cool things happen there. It's really an amazing experience.
How many paranormal experiences occur, Brandon, because the person who died, who comes back, never had some unfinished business and had to tell somebody or wanted to get something done?
I, you know, I don't know a percentage on that. I would say that, you know, a lot of the cases out there of ghostly encounters have to do with easing or coping with a psychological injury, like the death of a father or something like
right.
that. You know, you know, you're sort of struggling with the death. There's all these emotions happening. So, you know, the body sort of, the electricity or the emotions signify a psychological injury, and that sort of sets in motion a plan to sort of heal this psychological wound through whatever means possible. So maybe if you're not able to cope through normal means, you might use unconventional means, you know, and if collective unconsciousness or collective consciousness exists and memories, personalities and experiences of all of our humans are sort of stored in the atmosphere, you might be able to tap into this field and get some sort of resolution, like your father showing up and saying, don't be sad, I'm in a better place, you know. And I think these things, the research out there really says that I think it's up to 80% of elderly people experience these bereavement apparitions associated with their dead spouse 1 month after their death. So that's a pretty high number, 80%.
That's huge, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And perhaps these bereavement apparitions or visits from the deceased shortly after death are kind of more important to our individual psyches. And perhaps apparitions could be sort of a way to process emotions and ensure that our psychological well-being of the survivor. You know, a final goodbye from the deceased, it could help us move on through crisis or grief. Maybe if we didn't have that when the person died, it might be a good way to sort of move towards resolution. And when I talk to these people that have these encounters, they often report feeling more at ease or accepting of the loved one's death after these apparitions. And I think on TV, usually ghosts are negative, 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 but there's a lot of positive that can come out of a ghostly encounter. You know, this idea of, wait a minute, there is something more to life, or there is something to look forward to. It's just not all negative and demons and things like that.
Brandon, what have you concluded about the people who are more receptive to these kinds of apparitions and encounters than others? What's so special about them?
That's a great question. I wish I had a definite answer for that. I think, you know, something neurobiologically is different about them. You know, when they put them, there's some tests out there, specifically with people who claim to be really sensitive to electricity and things like that.
They're like human magnets or something, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You know, the research is kind of sometimes 50-50, if you want to think about that, saying that this phenomenon exists and it doesn't exist. But there's some really unique experimental designs that, you know, where they're actually doing fMRIs and EEGs, and what they're finding is their brain is actually, and their bodies are reacting to this electricity at very low levels. So there's some sort of objective evidence that they can detect things that are more sensitive, that other people in the general population can't, you know. So, and this is true for, listen, we all experience pain differently, right? And they've shown that through yep. fMRIs as well. So you know, I might get poked with a pin, and to me, it's a horrible, painful event. And for you, it's not really that.
It doesn't hurt at all. Stay with us, Brandon. We're going to talk more when we come back. We'll also take phone calls, get another couple stories of some of your case studies when we come back.